I'm going to call this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order out of respect for people's time. We do not yet have a quorum, but we are able to take testimony. So I know there are some people here from Rochester, and I believe that actually Representative Edelson, would you like to go first? How about we do that?
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for being here.
Chair and members. Well, actually, bring away the phone, Mary. Chair, we're just trying to figure out where the bill's going next.
Oh, okay. Yes, I have that here.
Okay.
I have it as going to the Ways and Means Committee. We can't make the motion yet because we don't have a quorum. So.
Oh, very good. Okay. Yes. All right, got it. Well, Chair and members, House File 910 is a renewal of the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee. Hearing loss is one of the most prevalent conditions that can be identified at birth. Before 2007, newborn hearing screening was a voluntary act in Minnesota. Not all hospitals screened for hearing loss. A screening mandate was passed in 2007, and along with it, a newborn hearing screening advisory committee was created. The committee has brought professionals, parents, and advocates together to advise the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Department of Education on how to monitor progress continuously and improve early hearing detection and intervention systems. The committee expires this year, and this bill will allow them to continue the great work they do. The advisory committee, Chair, it ensures that training, screening, referral, diagnosis, tracking, and evaluation systems are in place. It ensures that culturally appropriate interventions are in place so that children are ready for kindergarten. And it evaluates program outcomes to increase effectiveness and efficiency. Today, I have to testify Laura Godfrey, the co-chair of the committee, as my first testifier.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Godfrey.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee.
Please just identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Laura Godfrey. I'm a parent of a child who has a hearing loss. I also manage Minnesota Hands and Voices, which is part of a national nonprofit serving families who have children that are deaf and hard of hearing. And then, as mentioned, I'm the co-chair of the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee. So thank you, Representative Edelson, for introducing HF 910. We're asking for the renewal of the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee. When my son was born, the average age of identification of a child with a hearing loss was 3.5 years. Because of the work of the committee, babies get a diagnosis of hearing loss from a medical provider close to age 3 months. Since 2007, the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee has brought together professionals, parents, advocates that have a stake in improving early hearing detection and intervention systems, otherwise known as EDI. They wouldn't all be in the same room if we didn't have the committee. We learn from each other and monitor and continuously improve the system. Because of our work, Minnesota has one of the best systems in the country. Because of it, we have strong standards and policies. The work of the committee needs to continue. From 2017 to 2018, the committee recommended the following protocols to the Minnesota Department of Health. These included medical guidelines that were updated, revised guidelines for hearing screening after the newborn period to the kindergarten age, audiology assessment guidelines, and the committee has also begun work to revise the 2018 guidelines for pediatric amplification and the 2019 guidelines for audiologist referral to early intervention and family-to-family support. We have more work to do. The system isn't perfect. But we're getting there. The committee is required to provide an update every 2 years, which provides more transparency and accountability. We urge you to vote to continue to support this important piece of legislation.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Godfrey.
Thank you, Chairman. Well, before I call up my next testifier, I also want to just clarify for this bill also adds two representatives to the committee structure. So it will be one representative from the Deaf Mentor Program, and the second one would be a representative of the Minnesota State Academy of the Deaf from the Minnesota State Academy Board. My next testifier is Danielle Gornaris from the Deaf Mentor Program.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chairman Freiberg, members of the committee, can you hear me? My name is Danielle Gornaris. I am the manager of the Deaf Mentor Family Program at LifeTrack. The amendment adds deaf mentors to the advisory board, and I'm here to explain why it's important. Deaf Mentor Family Program focuses on communication needs of families with children who are deaf and hard of hearing from birth to the age of six. The Deaf Mentor Family Program assists these families by providing instruction in American Sign Language, early visual communication methods, and deaf culture through a trained deaf mentor who is deaf or hard of hearing at the family's home environment. Deaf mentors have been chosen based on their fluency in American Sign Language, their ability to communicate easily with hearing families or hearing family members, their comfort with young children, and the ability to support family decisions. The deaf mentor sessions provide the family with deaf and hard of hearing children for up to 2 hours per week for 2 years. When the bill passed in 2007, there was a small grant program. Now deaf mentors are written into the statute as part of the EDI system. Adding deaf mentors to the advisory committee would strengthen the mentoring and tracking process we have in place and add visual language acquisition. The advisory committee could add guidelines with visual language acquisition. Because of the changes that were made in the federal EHDI reauthorization law, the federal funder of the state EHDI systems, HRSA, will add reporting requirements for visual language acquisition. Minnesota is ahead of the game, because we have the funding mechanism in place that covers the cost and a system in place. They need to be integrated into the system and made part of the advisory committee. I urge you to pass this important bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Did you have additional testifiers, Representative Edelson?
No, Chair, I do not.
Okay. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay. I'm going to lay this bill over for the time being. Representative Edelson, if you could just stay in the audience as soon as we are at a quorum, I will bring you back and take action on your bill initially. So are there any members? Are there any member questions? Yes, Representative Mason. Actually, if you could stay up, that would be great.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. It's not a question. It's a comment. But I remember when I first came to the legislature, I was on a committee hearing about how difficult it was for some parents to get their children the attention that they needed. And I just remember one mother in particular was just in tears because I think her child was not identified till he was 7 years old. So thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Mason. Are there any additional member questions or comments? Thank you. Yep, and if you could please stick around, Representative Wilson, that would be great. The next, I know there are, we're just for the benefit of the people in the audience there, I know we're competing with a reception at the governor's mansion right now, so there are a few members not here. And I know there are other committees also meeting at the same time. But I want to make sure we get all testifiers to have the opportunity to come speak to us. So I know there are people here, Representative Mason, would you be ready to present House File 703? I know there are people from Rochester here to testify in support of that bill.
Good
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe some of the testifiers might want to come to the table right away as well. I would like to move House File 703.
I'm sorry, how about you wait?
Got it.
Yeah, thank you. If you could just please describe House File 703, okay. That would be great.
Okay. Years ago, there was put into law that there are limitations on how local governments can pay or compensate their workers. And this bill takes away those limitations or restrictions. And I think some of the testifiers will show you how important it is that we do repeal that legislation.
Welcome
I'll
to
turn
the,
it over to my testifiers.
Sure. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your time.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Linda Hillenbrand, and I'm the Director of Human Resources for the City of Rochester. And I would like to thank you for the opportunity to visit with you about the existing salary cap limitations in place for local government employees. Recently, I've had a conversation with a city colleague who currently has the wage rate capped at the 2019 established limit. This individual is applying for another position in our region, which offers a compensation package in excess of $300,000, substantially more than the capped limit. Historically, some individuals have stayed employed in government due to the PERA pension program. However, when an employee has their wages capped, their motivation to stay employed in government may be diminished as the cap has a limiting impact on pension growth. Over the past 4 years, the City of Rochester has experienced approximately 70% turnover in the department head and or executive level positions. In anticipation of this transition and to correct the wage compression issues that have surfaced as a result of the salary cap, the department head job descriptions and wage schedules were reviewed by an external evaluator. The outcome of this process resulted in a new wage schedule for the department heads. For 11 of these positions, the new range maximum pay rate exceeds the state's wage cap. Coupled with the tight labor market trends and the need to hire employees higher in the corresponding pay range, the city has extended employment offers to candidates with the caveat that we invite them to join our team. However, their wages most likely will be capped in the near future. That can be a very difficult message to deliver to job candidates who live outside of Minnesota and are not familiar with this compensation limit. Further, when conducting a nationwide search for a new city administrator in 2017, the city employed an outside recruitment firm, Springstead Waters, to assist in attracting eligible candidates for this vacancy. The Springstead Waters consultant indicated the salary cap had a limiting impact on our national recruitment efforts. One of the prospective candidates came from a city in Iowa with a population less than half the size of Rochester, which currently has a population of approximately 114,000. After expressing concerns about the income potential, this individual withdrew from the process and received a counteroffer from their respective city council, which was only slightly less than the Rochester wage salary cap. The candidate acknowledged that the challenges of the Rochester position were significantly more complex in scope, and there was no assurance that the city would be able to get approval from the state of Minnesota to compensate at an amount commensurate with the required performance. This candidate also completed research in 2017 by surveying the base salary and other compensable benefits received by city managers, administrators in communities with populations greater than 40,000 in Iowa and contiguous states with which it shares a border. This information revealed that an average base salary of $181,705 was paid to city managers or administrators in communities with an average population of 72,000. When deferred compensation and car allowances were included, the average compensation level increased to $195,800. This private data collected by the candidate is consistent with information obtained by the city. Having participated in salary surveys with bordering states, I am very aware that it is not uncommon for other states to pay their executive level professionals considerably higher wages than what is allowed in Minnesota. This fact alone adds a significant impediment to the regional and national recruitment processes utilized for our executive and senior level positions. Rochester Public Utilities is a department of the City of Rochester. Additional salary survey information evaluated by the city is obtained from the American Public Power Association. Our wage rates for the general manager and respective director-level positions are not competitive with the compensation packages offered by investor-owned facilities and/or local cooperatives. In 2018, the third quartile wage rate for a general manager position was $196,000. For those utilities like RPU, which generate more than $100 million in annual revenue, the median wage rate for a general manager is $275,000, with the third quartile wage rate of $322,000. Because of our concerns to attract and retain high-caliber individuals, a waiver request was submitted for 13 positions at year-end 2018. Two waivers were granted, one for the city administrator and one for the RPU general manager. Going through the waiver process for 13 positions is time-consuming and cumbersome. In working with the Minnesota management and budget personnel, the primary indicators for granting waivers seem to rely primarily on comparison budget and employee data for Minnesota municipalities. While this is important, we believe other market and economic conditions should be factored into this decision-making process. Even though these two waivers are helpful, it still does not address the ongoing concerns regarding market competitiveness that remains in the city for a number of positions. I imagine that one of your concerns you may have about removing the cap is that there would be an accelerated wage growth in several jurisdictions. As a taxpayer and the Director of Human Resources, I find our council members to make thoughtful, deliberate decisions with a clear understanding that they are ultimately accountable to the Rochester citizens. With this understanding, please consider taking the necessary steps to eliminate the salary regulation and allow our city council to be accountable for employee wages. Thank you again for your time and consideration of an important topic that clearly impacts the ongoing recruitment and retention of executive level positions in the city of Rochester.
Thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Our next testifier.
Sure. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hi. Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Luke Hellier, and I'm a member of the Lakeville City Council. Thank you for the opportunity today to share my support for House File 703. I was elected 2 years ago, and I've had the privilege to serve on our personnel committee. I'd like to share an example of a recent hiring process for our city. In 2018, our Director of Public Works left his job for a new opportunity in southern Minnesota, and our human resources team worked diligently to find his replacement. We had a dozen or so candidates, and two of which came from out of state, but neither was a right fit. Following several months of not filling the position, we hired a consultant at a fee of $30,000 to recruit and find a qualified candidate, and we ultimately hired someone from another Minnesota suburb. I share that story not because of the issues with compensation, but to share how difficult it can be to find the right candidate for a job. Not unlike the private sector, finding qualified candidates for positions can be frustrating and downright difficult. On top of that, a burden on our budget and taxpayers. One of the ways to prevent having to spend significant resources on finding qualified workers is adequately compensating current employees and to keep them happy and incentivize them to stay. 2018, we even went under a compensation study to ensure our staff was compensated at a level to the neighboring cities that we find ourselves in. Unfortunately, when it comes to our top staff, our hands are tied to ensure that we are paying a competitive wage with above-average benefits. I'd much rather give a raise of a few thousand dollars to a qualified employee than spend tens of thousands on a search firm to find a candidate from another region. Opponents of the change might say that lifting the ban would result in a bidding war among cities about who can pay the most. But as far as I know, that has not happened with school superintendents who are currently exempt from the law. In theory, capping compensation on municipal employees should set a level playing field among cities in recruiting and retaining employees. However, in practice, it's unworkable. Due to the current waiver process, Lakeville and cities like ours have to compete not only with other cities in the state, but from other regions. In particular, cities like Edina and Rochester, who are allowed to have the waiver, that stays with the employees. So if their administrator leaves, they could come to the city of Lakeville and offer them however amount of much money, and we wouldn't be able to compete and offer a comparable wage. I urge you to support the lifting of the cap and have the opportunity to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Councilmember Hellier. Is there anybody else who would like to speak? Yes. Did you have a?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yes. Commissioner.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Sheila Kiskaden. I am an Olmsted County Commissioner and here representing the Minnesota Inter-County Association and the Association of Minnesota Counties, both of which have platform positions recommending the elimination of the salary cap. I believe the salary cap went on in about 1977, and it was a political decision at the time, and it's been pretty much a political decision since then. And I think we're, in today's world, we're recognizing that our our cities and counties are really managing services well and managing their budgets well. I think you can count on us to be prudent as we make decisions about salary compensation. But right now, the salary cap is creating problems for us, as you've heard from my colleague from Rochester and the gentleman from Lakeville. So we have a situation where we have high technology needs. And you know from your own experience, if you don't get the right technology support in place, you have problems creating the technology systems and platforms that support the customer service that you're intending to have. We've been having difficulty recruiting technology ahead of our ITS services because it is a really technical field and a very competitive field. We want the best in government services and every level of appropriate management, and the salary cap has now become an impediment to good decision-making and good management at the local level. Rochester applied for 13 waivers, received two. Olmsted County applied for five and received none, yet we're the third largest city of the first class within our county. We're the eighth largest county. We have a broader scope of services that we provide than the city does. So it's, you know, we're managing everything from a waste to energy facility to child protection to adult services to a jail, and our administrators are not eligible for a waiver on the salary cap. Our budget's bigger, our scope of responsibility is bigger. So the waiver process itself is not resulting in good outcomes, and I think you're creating some unintended consequences with that you never envisioned. I think it's time for the salary cap to be eliminated and for us to look to the future for appropriate levels of management in cities and counties, just like you expect school districts to do it. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Commissioner Kiskaden. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay. Are there any questions from members? Okay. All right. Seeing none, I will lay this over for the moment. And Representative Mason,
you.
If you could come back to the table here. You're on the committee, so you will still be here. Representative Hansen, Representative Moran, do you have testifiers? Okay. So is Representative Lean in the audience? Welcome to the committee, Representative Lean. You have House File 1862. Could you please describe your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, do you also want me to speak to the amendment?
Sure, that would be helpful.
Okay. House File 1862 would increase the appropriation for taxpayer assistance grants that support VITA and TCE tax preparation sites across the state. The current base appropriation is $400,000 per fiscal year. VITA tax preparation sites offer free tax filing assistance for low-income households, the elderly, people with disabilities, and people with limited English-speaking capabilities. TCE tax preparation sites offer free tax filing assistance for people who are over the age of 60. The bill also expands eligible uses for taxpayer assistance grants to include support for financial capability services to tax filers for the purpose of setting up taxpayers for long-term fiscal financial sustainability and success. And this is the element of the bill that I'm most excited about. To speak just briefly to the A2 amendment, it does provide some technical cleanup language on the bill, provides more transparency for partnerships between program applicants and private sector financial service institutions. It provides the Department of Revenue with discretion on the type of technical assistance the department will offer to program applicants, and it increases the appropriation in the bill from $200,000 per fiscal year to an additional $400,000 per fiscal year. Mr. Chair, committee members, I will now walk through the different sections of the bill. Section 1, Subdivision 1, establishes new definitions for financial capability services. Some of these services include assistance with opening savings or transactional accounts that meet FDIC standards for model safe account templates, assistance with depositing all or part of a tax refund into these accounts, assistance with obtaining and reviewing credit reports and credit scores, assistance with obtaining bank history reports, some financial coaching for independent financial success, and other services such as credit and debt counseling services. Section 1, Subdivision 2 adds financial capability services to the allowable use of these grant dollars. Section 1, Subdivision 3 establishes eligibility guidelines for grant applicants. These include being nonprofit organizations registered with the IRS for VITA or TCE services, able to commit that the organizations are also able to commit one staff or volunteer person to coordinate financial capability services and offer free assistance to opening savings or transactional accounts, depositing, again, all or part of the tax refunds into these accounts, or purchasing savings bonds with the tax refund dollars. Subdivision 4 protects against conflict of interest by prohibiting grantees from receiving compensation or funding from a financial institution that is in exchange for or contingent on the applicant offering specific products or services. Program applicants must also disclose any funding from tax from financial service institutions whose products or services will be offered at the VITA or TCE tax preparation sites. Subdivision 5 pertains to the Revenue Commissioner's public notice of the grant availability. Subdivision 6 lays out the types of technical assistance the Department of Revenue may offer, and some of these assistance may include help with tax prep site location and development, VITA or TCE site coordinator training, tax prep training on tax law, support in developing volunteer training, and also information and help with tax return software and e-filing training. The department is a new partner in this program in providing technical assistance, not only for the new financial capability services, but also for the existing tax prep services. An organization, Prepare and Prosper, which is a nonprofit out of St. Paul, used to provide this technical assistance for tax prep sites across the state until 2017. The organization used foundational grant dollars to provide the assistance. However, these grant dollars are no longer available, and the Department of Revenue seemed the best suited partner as the next logical partner to provide the technical assistance for these services. Subdivision 7 mandates reporting by grant recipients on how the grant dollars were used. And Section 2 of the bill increases the appropriation from the current base funding each year to $800,000 each year. So it would be an additional $400,000 each year. It is typical for tax preparation applicant requests to be at least twice the available amount of base appropriations in any given year. The additional dollars are also for the expanded financial capability service functions under the bill. Section 2 allows the Department of Revenue to use up to 5% of the additional appropriations for administrative purposes. And, Mr. Chair, committee members, at this time I can either stand for questions or turn it over to Tracy Fishman from Prepare and Prosper for additional comments.
Thank you, Representative Lean. We do now have a quorum, so I would like a motion to approve the minutes of the March 8th meeting. Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the minutes, and I don't see Representative Bonner's name on the minutes. Was she here or was she excused the other day? So we either have to correct the minutes or maybe bring them back tomorrow at our next meeting and fix them then.
Okay. We'll bring them back then. I know that was the day there was multiple committees going on, and she was here. She might have been in the other committee that was meeting at that time. So we'll confirm that and bring it back at the next meeting. So I will move that Representative Lean's bill, House File 1862, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. And I will also move the A2-1 Author's Amendment, which Representative Lean has already explained. So all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So the bill is before us in the shape the author would like. Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Tracy Fishman. I'm the executive director of Prepare and Prosper, a nonprofit organization based in the Twin Cities. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1862, the Tax Time Savings Bill, to increase funding for the Taxpayer Assistance Grants Program to allow some funding to be used for financial capability and savings promotion services, and to authorize the Department of Revenue to offer technical assistance to support and strengthen free tax preparation sites throughout the state. I want to start by thanking our chief sponsor, Representative Lean, as well as members of this committee signed on as co-sponsors, Representatives Elkins and Gomez. Thank you. Prepare and Prosper is Minnesota's largest provider of free tax assistance. We leverage the expertise of 550 trained and certified volunteers to provide free tax assistance to nearly 13,000 people. We also return nearly $25 million in tax refunds each year. We currently run 9 sites throughout the Twin Cities, and we're open year-round at our main location in St. Paul. We also link customers with financial services and savings opportunities to increase the financial impact of their tax refunds. Last year, we helped over 1,300 people save nearly $1.9 million of their tax refunds. We opened savings accounts and prepaid accounts on site. We assist with direct deposit of refunds into new or existing checking and or savings accounts. This is especially important for the high number of unbanked or underbanked tax filers who would otherwise pay the high cost of transacting in cash, such as paying for check cashing services, purchasing money orders to pay bills, and more. We also pull credit reports and make referrals to our financial coaching program or to financial counseling at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. The Tax Time Savings Bill would help organizations that offer free tax assistance increase our collective ability to meet the significant demand this time of year, especially for free tax assistance and integrated financial services across the state. Tax credits like the Earned Income Tax Credit and Minnesota's Working Family Credit can greatly boost a family's income. Taxpayers use their hard-earned tax refunds to meet basic needs like paying bills, putting food on their table, and hopefully to save for a rainy day and a brighter future. Free tax programs, many of us part of the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Network that you heard referenced earlier, serve as an important conduit in connecting taxpayers to these refunds or in meeting their tax obligations. So with the integrated financial services, taxpayers can move beyond the tax time benefit and ultimately grow their savings, reduce their student loan or credit card debt, and improve their credit scores and more. When taxpayers come to us, they work with a trained and IRS-certified volunteer, and every tax return is reviewed by a volunteer tax reviewer. Our extensive training and certification requirements contribute to a very high accuracy rate. Nationally, our accuracy rate is about 93%, which is among the highest in the industry. At Prepare and Prosper, our preparation for the tax season is a months-long process. Well before the tax season's launch, we recruit and train our hundreds of volunteers, and we create or update more than 50 forms to use in our tax clinics and many trainings and related documents. Our trainings cover federal and state tax law, which are ever-evolving, as you know, and myriad topics relevant to the Minnesota and federal tax codes, as well as how to use the tax software and standards of conduct and expectations of volunteering with our organization. We also train on the important role of tax time in facilitating financial wellness and security for many of our customers. This promotion of savings at tax time is both unique and opportune. We have a savings crisis in this country. According to the Federal Reserve Board, about 40% of adults today don't have enough liquid savings to cover a $400 emergency. The Tax Time Savings Bill would provide much-needed resources to current and new free tax programs across the state, allowing grantees to recruit, train, and support volunteers and part-time staff at our tax sites. It would also support purchasing needed items such as laptops, printers, and promotional materials, support the integration of financial services at tax time. The bill also authorizes, as you know, the Department of Revenue to offer technical assistance to help strengthen existing and support potentially new free tax preparation sites around the state. As Representative Lean noted, this is a service that we at Prepare and Prosper did provide in the past. We recognize that a gap now exists, and this TA and training support have been important for free tax prep sites over the years to train site managers in the complexities of running free tax prep sites and also successful in training and supporting the volunteers. There are a lot of topics that we've covered, and you heard Representative Lean reference some of them before, that have to do with managing a site, running a VITA program, developing marketing plans, understanding how to use the tax prep software, understanding tax law, and more. So because we discontinued offering that tax prep technical assistance, we would be pleased to see the Department of Revenue step into that role, since they bring great and trusted expertise and experience in running free tax prep sites. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you again for this opportunity to testify in support of the Tax Time Savings Bill and its importance in supporting Minnesota's low and moderate income tax filers.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on House File 1862? Okay. Seeing none, are there any member questions? Yes, Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lee, and thank you so much for bringing this forward. I used to work at a nonprofit that did the free tax clinic here in St. Paul, and just this past year, they were able to return over $300,000 back to the community. Between the time I started there and to when I left, we increased the amount of dollars that went back into the community by over 270%. So it went from about $57,000 to over $200,000 that we're able to give back to people. And so not only that, but we also recruited a lot of student volunteers to do this work, to be the certified tax preparers. They would come to us looking to get real life experience. And a lot of them also were here on student visas, so weren't legally able to work in the country, but could volunteer their time to do this and really give back to the community. A lot of them were bilingual, and many of my former volunteers are now working in the field. We had one that had an internship with the U.S. IRS, and so it's a really awesome program, and one of the things that we did do there was some of this financial literacy counseling, opening up savings accounts, getting them into the FAME program, some of the other financial programs that we offered, and we did that without support. And I know, too, when we had a big struggle when Prepare and Prosper wasn't able to offer the training anymore on where we would get that training. And so I think this would be really helpful on making sure that we can get that training and that offer those other services. So instead of people relying on those tax rebates and refunds, that they can get ahead of the game and use that to build assets and build build wealth. And that's really the goal of this, is to move people out of poverty. And so thank you so much.
Thank you.
No question there.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Cagle. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Being unbanked, as they say, affects people in ways you wouldn't ordinarily think of it. Many cases. So, in my time on the Metropolitan Council, I was constantly a proponent of trying to get a higher percentage of our riders using the go-to cards rather than cash, because it was clear that it was a far more cost-effective way to collect fares. But when we looked into why more people weren't using them, the biggest obstacle that we identified is that a significant portion of our low-income riders just did not have bank accounts. Mm-hmm. So, anything that we can do to help, lower-income people to become banked, as they say, is going to help them in a myriad of ways, and not just in terms of things like building a credit score, but the other services that are opened up to them are incredibly important. So I strongly support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Is there additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Lean?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I appreciate you hearing this bill, and I ask for your support to help all Minnesotans get the most out of their tax filings and to get on their way to better financial sustainability. Thank you.
Yep, thank you, Representative Lean. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1862, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Lean. I'm going to bring Representative Edelson back here, and while she's coming up, I am going to move House File 910, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I will also move the A3 author's amendment, which you have already explained, I believe.
Yeah, it's just technical.
Yep. So any discussion? All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape you would like. Is there any member discussion of House File 910? We have already had testimony on it. Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 910 be recommended to pass and re-referred as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Member.
Representative Mason, would you like to go back up? While you are doing, I suppose you're on the committee, but since you're making your way up there, I will move House File 703 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. And there is no amendment to this one, I believe. So we have already had testimony on this. Is there any member discussion on House File 703? Okay. Seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Mason?
Just the fact that the current situation is truly an impediment to good governance, so I encourage your support of this. Thank you.
Thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 703 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Moran, thank you for your patience. While Representative Moran is coming forward, I will move that House File 342 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Welcome to the committee. If you could please describe your bill, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, members, I believe that we all share the values that families belong together and that all children in Minnesota, no matter their geographic location, their socioeconomic status, or their cultural background, deserve to live in safe, loving homes that nurture positive development. Children depend on having a stable environment to call home and with the sense of belonging, community, and culture that it brings. This plays an important role in their prospect for future success. Unfortunately, there are deep systemic disparities within the Minnesota Child Protection System. There are failing our children and parents alike in the African-American community, and children who are disproportionately represented in the Minnesota child welfare system. I've both heard stories from communities and have seen the data that shows black families are disproportionately represented in out-of-home placement or foster care. We can sit on the sidelines and wait for improvements to come within the same system. Or today before you, we have House File 342, the Minnesota African-American Preservation and Child Disproportionality Act. We know that in Minnesota, a black child is three times more likely to be removed from their home than a white child. And once a child is taken away from their family, we know that the consequences that can await them. These can range from the lack of success in school to having poor health outcomes and becoming involved in the criminal justice system. This is unacceptable, and as policymakers, we have a shared responsibility to end inequities like this. So I believe legislators, both Democratic and Republicans, should share the goal of keeping families together. Fundamentally, families belong together. The Minnesota African American Family Preservation and Child Welfare Disproportionality Act will end the unfair, arbitrary removal of African American children from their home. It will increase the chances if a child is removed from the home that they will be able to stay with another family member as opposed to a foster family of strangers. The bills create an African American Child Welfare Oversight and Disproportionality Council to monitor case plans and services to ensure that the unique needs of children who are disproportionately involved in the system have their needs met. It supports the best interests of children and promotes the stability and security of children disproportionately involved in the Minnesota child welfare system through enhanced, customized, reasonable efforts to prevent removal from their families. It also promotes strategies in areas such as unemployment, education, and housing to strengthen opportunities instead of separating children from their families And the bills require the African-American cultural competency training for individuals working with the child protection system. We know that healthy families are vital to the success of our children and ultimately our state. Everyone has a stake in ensuring that the Minnesota child protection system is fair and equitable. And I am committed to working with all stakeholders to ensure that we are enacting needed changes like those contained within this bill to ensure our child protection system truly has the best interest of all Minnesota children in mind. So I ask you to help us to address these disparities faced by families through House File 342. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Representative Moran. We did hear very compelling testimony on this on the Health and Human Services Policy Committee, which I also hear on. For government operations discussion, the provision of this bill that's within our jurisdiction is Section 9, which is on page 9, line 18, which you mentioned, Representative Moran. Thank you for that. It's the African-American and Disproportionality Child Welfare Oversight Council. So the creation of that council is within the jurisdiction of the Government Operations Committee. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Moran?
Well, I just want to thank you so much for, Mr. Chair, for allowing this bill to come to the committee. I think we are all in the same place of wanting to create great outcomes for all kids in the state of Minnesota, and this is just one way that we can move forward and have an oversight with the council to move all families forward. So I hope I can get your support.
Thank you, Representative Moran. I will renew my motion that House File 342 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hansen, you have two bills here. Would you like to do the Legislative Audit Commission one first?
Mr. Chair, since the Legislative Auditor is here, I'd like to do the Legislative Audit one first.
Sure, sounds good. So I will move that House File 2225 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. If you could please introduce your bill, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This bill, over the past few years, there's been a number of mandates put into statute for the legislative auditor to do and what this bill does, the Legislative Audit Commission met and made a recommendation based on looking at some of those mandates to remove them, and we voted to introduce this bill, and that's why it's in front of you, and I have with me the legislative auditor to describe it.
Welcome to the committee, Auditor Nobles. If you could please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and I would like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for hearing this bill, and I would like to thank Representative Hansen for sponsoring it. He is currently the chair of the Legislative Audit Commission and has previously been the chair on occasions. And as he said, this bill really addresses both the Legislative Audit Commission, how it operates, and the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And I think we have a very good working relationship, particularly on choosing topics that are of concern and interest to members. And so this bill is really kind of a housekeeping bill to, as Representative Hansen said, clean up some of the provisions that are put in that really are either not necessary or just outdated. So let me just walk through it very quickly. So the first section would amend a provision that is the provision that the Legislative Audit Commission uses for providing topics for the Legislative Auditor's Office to evaluate. And we're currently in that process, and as you know, we reach out to members, and the Legislative Audit Commission just this morning considered all of the proposals that members have suggested, and so the Commission has a process of taking into consideration your concerns and interests. So this would simply say in the first part of this section that the Legislative Audit Commission will give consideration to economic development topics. Now, the reason for that is that in Section 4, we are repealing an earlier provision that was put in some years ago that required the Legislative Audit Commission to choose an economic development topic. We've been through that process now for several years. I think it's worked fine, but I think we really need to sort of unshackle the Legislative Audit Commission from that requirement. they will give due consideration to economic development topics. They're always of concern, and I think it's just more appropriate that you allow them to make that decision rather than mandating it as a requirement in law. So in Section 1, there is also, in Paragraph B, the language is stricken, and that's because it's just a very outdated and not used provision. It was put in over 10 years ago. It's never been used. It really was, again, a mandate on the Commission to direct the legislative auditor to consider individual proposals, suggestions from members, and, again, the Commission already has that provision. So Section 2 is a provision which I think is very important, and that is it requires agencies to notify the legislative auditor if there's been an unlawful access or providing of not public data to somebody who does not lawfully have the authority to have it. Section 3, says that the Legislative Audit Commission, the legislative auditor, are going to give high consideration, high priority to audits of the Department of Human Services, but it strikes out a lot of fairly cumbersome and very prescriptive provisions. So, and as I said, Mr. Chairman, Section 4 is the repealer, and that's the bill.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to speak on House File 2225? Okay. Seeing none, any member discussion? Okay. Seeing none, any closing remarks? Representative Hansen.
I'm going to ask for your support.
Thank you for your brevity. I will renew my motion that House File 2225 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Auditor Nobles and Representative Hansen. If you could please stay up there because you also have House File 2070. And I will move that House File 2070 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 2070 is a bill to establish the Rusty Patch Bumblebee as the official bee of the state of Minnesota. And I know that the state of Minnesota has several symbols, but the purpose behind House File 2070 is to do more than just having a symbol. It's to protect the Rusty Patch Bumblebee, which is the first bumblebee, native bee, that was put on the endangered species list. I have with me Elaine Evans, Assistant Extension Professor from the University of Minnesota, to talk a little bit about the Rusty Patch Bumblebee. Dr. Evans.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee. I am Elaine Evans. Rick Hansen mentioned that I am a extension educator and researcher at the Bee Lab at the University of Minnesota. I have been working on bumblebees for 25 years. When I first started working on bumblebees, the rusty patch bumblebee was one of the common bees that I would see wherever I was looking at bumblebees. But in the year 2000, there was a sudden decline, and I suddenly saw none, and they had disappeared from all across eastern North America. Since that time, I was motivated to found the Minnesota Bumblebee Survey. Since 2007, we've been looking to see if we could still find the rusty patch bumblebee in Minnesota. And since that time, Minnesota has emerged as a champion of the rusty patch bumblebee, and our actions here are really crucial to the protection and the recovery of this species. In 2018, there were a total of 471 rusty patch bumblebees seen anywhere in the world, which isn't a lot for an insect. Insects, they're usually pretty numerous. Of those 471, 165 of those were in Minnesota. So Minnesota is housing 35% of all the known rusty patch bumblebees in the world. And not only that, but they're widespread throughout Minnesota. Over the past 10 years, we've had volunteers that have been documenting these bumblebees, and they've been found as far north as Clearwater and Itasca counties, as far south as Houston and Jackson counties. So this bumblebee is really representing Minnesota, our beauty, our resiliency of our natural resources. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has identified public awareness as one of the key things that we need to do to preserve this insect and have the species actually recover. The goal of listing something as an endangered species is that we have it be not endangered anymore through protecting.
So designation of the Rusty Patch Bumblebee as the Minnesota State Bee would go a long way in raising awareness and increasing opportunities to protect remaining populations of this important and beautiful pollinator.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Evans. Is there anybody else who would like to speak on House File 2070? Okay, seeing none, I'll turn to member discussion. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I imagine it would be to Representative Hansen. 111, and I'm not familiar, it says a species of most concern. Is that something that's defined in statute now?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Vogel. That is a term that is used in the Federal Endangered Species Act, which the Rusty Patch Bumblebee is protected under.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then in 112, it goes on to say must coordinate efforts to protect, and I'm wondering what is, you know, that could be a fairly broad thing here relative to what we would be considering then to be a endangered species. What is meant by must coordinate efforts to protect?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, so the Environmental Quality Board has the responsibility of coordinating the agencies. So whether it's DNR, PCA, Bowser, all the various agencies, they are the coordinating role to bring them together and working. So that must coordinate is this provides them with that specific responsibility to protect the Rusty Patch Bumblebee. So you may have, you know, we probably traditionally think about the Pollution Control Agency, but maybe not MnDOT. And maybe there's a place on a rest area where there's habitat and a rusty patch bumblebee. So that coordination, we have citizen scientists around the state that are locating, now they take a picture of it and locate where it's at. And so coordinating that effort, working with the University of Minnesota, the EQB does not have the authority over the University of Minnesota, but it does have that responsibility to coordinate the state agencies. So this would provide that responsibility at the state level for bringing people together and make sure that they're communicating.
Representative Vogel?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the planned path here? I know it's going back to Ways and Means, but is it going to Ag or Environment or other committees as well relative to kind of the large scope of this thing? Do you know?
It's up to the Ways and Means Chair, but I believe Representative Hansen may have some ideas about where it might go.
It's an act relating to natural resources, and it will be coming to the Environmental Finance, Natural Resources Finance Committee.
Okay. Representative Vogel. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This isn't really to the bill, but just a burning question. What's the difference between a bumblebee and a honeybee?
I won't take that one.
Ms. Evans, that sounds like a good question for you.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. They are closely related, so they're kind of cousins. They're in the same family biologically, but they are very different. The honeybee is a managed bee, so honeybees are not native to North America. They were brought here for honey production and wax production and pollination, whereas the bumblebees we have here are native. We didn't bring them here. They both are social bees, so they both live in colonies and have queens and workers and visit flowers and pollinate. But that's kind of the key differences between a managed bee and a bee that's just out living in nature.
All right. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hansen, thank you for bringing attention to this important issue. And I really appreciate the effort. It's well beyond the state bee part of it. I think the protection and the public awareness efforts are really crucial to, you know, for all of us, I think, and bringing attention. I think we all can learn so much from this. And sometimes when we do a state something, it isn't always positive, but I think in this case it's the other components that are just so important and so strong. So thank you for bringing it and moving the discussion needle, and because we all need to be aware of what's going on, and again, we all need to be educated as well too. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Are there additional member questions? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Hansen?
I would ask you just for your support, Representative Lilly. I actually voted against the state apple. If I was just doing this for being the state bee, I wouldn't be doing it. But I think
mighty fine apple.
It's a good apple, but I like the Harrelson actually a little better, but more traditional. But this is important because the state designation of the state bee would help with the protection efforts. We can help get the word out, and it is endangered. If we think of only 400 and some bees left in the world, we need to try to involve everybody. And by making this the state bee, I think that will help, and it's meaningful. So I'd ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. I will renew my motion that House File 2070 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative
Hansen. Thank you.
Representative Nelson, we have, you were first on the agenda. We have House File 968. And I believe you may have a testifier also. So I will move that House File 968 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Please describe your bill, Representative Nelson.
Well, Mr. Chair, and
And we have two amendments also. Is one amendment, I believe, is yours, the A1 amendment?
The A1 amendment is my amendment, so I'll move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Any discussion? Okay. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The bill is in the shape you would like it. If you could please.
I don't know where who's got the A2 amendment, but anyway. Mr. Chair, spring must be coming because, like certain bills every year that we get through the legislature, we see them over and over again sometimes. This is and earlier this year we had a bill to basically do this for one county. And I have in the past had amendments posted for that to allow all the counties to do that. To do this, to be able to, if they need to, if they choose to, and if they go through the proper procedures, to switch some elective offices to appointed offices. And the bill allows for that in all the counties, and it has provisions in there for referendum for the citizens that they want to change them back to elective offices. And there's the procedures in here for the counties to be able to change them back to elective offices. And right now, members, in your package, you should have a handout of a map of Minnesota that shows, I've got it here, but that shows the counties. The ones in the gray are ones that have already been one or multiple of those offices. There's been special legislation to allow those to be able to combine or to make these appointed offices. And we're up to like 47 counties out of 87 counties. And in the past, when we've had single bills, and some years we've had just one, I think we've had one so far this year for Representative Erickson. In other years, we've had three or four or five counties that have asked for different combinations of these. And I've asked the question, how many counties do we need to get to before it just makes sense to let them all have the permission to do that? And that's what my bill here does today, is allows all the counties to have that option. It's not requiring any county to do it. It's not saying they have to, but it says they can. But there's written their procedures laid out on how to do this. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have Mr. Hilgart here from the Counties Association. I think he's got some testimony, and he's here to answer questions. So, Mr. Chair, that's the bill.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, and I thank you very much. My name is Matt Hilgart. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. I represent all of Minnesota's 87 counties, and I think Chair Nelson hit everything on the spot. I'd be happy to take questions if there are questions about the history of this bill or the procedures that it takes to go through this process, but there are two handouts, as Chair Nelson mentioned. One, a map of kind of the process, what it takes, and two, a map of the counties who have, in one form or another, special legislation already passed to give them this authority.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgart. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 968? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion? Yes, Representative Lehman.
Just a question. I'm just curious. And I know my home county is in favor of this, Itasca County. But I'm just wondering, have there ever been any reverse referendums? What's the history with that?
Mr. Hilgart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, yes, there have been. I think there have been multiple in Ms. Dyson will probably know as well, but one specifically that I remember in my time here with the association is Lake County. They had special legislation that was passed, and then the voters actually put it on the referendum and reverted it back to an elected position, which is why, as you note in this process, there's, you know, public icons or clip arts here next to each step of the process. The public is involved in every single step of the process, including post-appointment, which allows them to put it back on the ballot and revert it back to an elected position. So in short, yes, this has actually been reverted back in a couple counties in the state.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
It's my understanding there's at least one county that has passed special legislation but has not moved forward with the appointed office, but they have passed legislation on the floor of the House and the Senate, and the governor signed it to allow them to do it, but they've chosen not to do it. So, like I said, this is not requiring them to do it. This is just giving the permission if they choose to do this. And usually what happens is somebody that's been in a position a long time as a county auditor or a treasurer or whatever that's held the office for a long time is going to not run for re-election, is going to retire, and to get somebody that's qualified to do that job by appointing it as opposed to having somebody off the street run and not have any clue what the job does. I mean, we all, especially the freshmen, are probably closer to that, know what it's like to step into these jobs cold turkey and all of a sudden have to do the job. Sometimes that causes issues and more training costs. This way they can hire someone by appointing them to that position and that can handle the job and has the necessary qualifications to do that.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any further member discussion or any members who would like to offer any additional amendments? Wanted to make sure on that one. Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and hopefully we can pass this, and there'll be one less bill we have to handle every year. Again, like the coming of spring, which is just around the corner. This bill, like I said, hopefully we won't have to see this again.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. I will renew my motion that House File 968, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Your bill is on its way, Representative Nelson. Thank you. Representative Detmer, I believe you are a substitute. Not that we're not happy to have you here. We're very happy to have you here. But I understand Representative Grossel was not able to make it, and you are filling in for him. So I will move that House File 172... be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. If you could please present the bill, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members here. Again, I'm filling in for Representative Russell. Just a quick overview. The bill establishes a third Friday of September of each year as Prisoners of War, POW, and Missing in Action, MIA, Recognition Day to honor the Minnesotans who have been prisoners of war or missing in action. The bill requires an annual gubernatorial proclamation. And just to continue on with that, there are more than 82,000 American military service members included and more than 1,500 of Minnesota's missing, unaccounted for and unrecoverable deep sea losses. Those are staggering numbers that we just many times we don't look at as legislators or the public. It is the federal government's duty to continue to try to bring the prisoners of war missing people back to their homes. And it is our duty as citizens to never forget the POWs and the MIAs. A POW and MIA flag flies over the House chamber. You know, when we drive up to the Capitol every day, we look up the Capitol, and we see over the House chamber the POW-MIA flag over the House chamber. You may have seen the missing man table at the local American Legion. If you've been to any events at your local VFW American Legion, you've probably seen the ceremony. And in your packet, you should have a map or a picture of what that ceremony looks like. I know I'm a member of both the VFW American Legion, and I've seen this ceremony many times at formal dinners or events that are put on. The missing man table is round with a white tablecloth, a single rose in the vase on the table with a red or yellow ribbon wrapped around the vase. The table there is a, there is a lemon slice on a plate, a salt shaker, an inverted glass, a holy Bible, a lit candle, and empty chairs. Let me just go through each one of these items. You should have a photo, as I mentioned, in your packet. The table is round to represent the everlasting concern of our loved ones who are POWs or MIAs. The tablecloth is white, symbolic of the purity of the soldiers' intentions and response to their country's call to arms. The red rose signifies the red blood that many soldiers have shed so they can, we can be free. The ribbon around the vase symbolizes the continued hope for the soldiers to return. The lemon slice represents the bitter fate of the missing. The salt reminds us of the countless tears of the families who wait at home for their loved ones to return. The inverted glass represents the fact that the missing cannot be, cannot partake. The Holy Bible, symbolic of the spiritual strength and faith that sustain those who are lost. The lit candle represents the hope of the soldier's return, and the empty chair is a reminder to us of the missing soldiers who are not present at the table. The U.S. Congress passed a resolution authorizing National POW MIA Recognition Day in 1979. Since 1986, the date has been on the third Friday in September. Each year, the President proclaims the National POW MIA Recognition Day. Many states also make this designation. Last year, a constituent brought to then-Representative Jason Rarick attention days before September 21, the third Friday in September last year, that 48 out of 50 states have proclaimed the date. Only Minnesota and California hadn't. Representative Rarick was able to get the Governor Dayton to issue a proclamation last minute and also had the House resolution issued. Now, House File 172 puts in statute that the third Friday in September every year is designated as the POW and MIA Recognition Day and requires the Governor to issue a proclamation. There are many days that observed in the state law that requires the Governor to issue a proclamation, including July is a higher veteran month, the Sunday before Memorial Day is Military Spouse Family Day, and August 7th is Combat Wounded Purple Heart Day, and there's several others. It is our continued duty as citizens to never forget those never forget that there are U.S. military service personnel who are prisoners of war are missing in action. Having the third Friday of every September designated as in statute for recognition of the POW and MIAs will help us remember and not never let them be forgotten. Again, Mr. Chair and committee members, I think we can put this together and beat California to the punch. And let's again thank you for hearing this bill and ask the committee to be favorable with, and consider passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Detmer. Is there anybody who would like to speak regarding House File 172? Okay, seeing no one, any member discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do support this bill. The only thing that has stuck out on me, and maybe it's because of the nasty email I got earlier this week, all of our missing POWs and MIAs are not Christians. Jewish and Islam and all sorts of other religion, and I guess that's with the nasty email I got about a judge that got sworn using the Quran. I think that's would be inclusive if all religions could be symbolized here. But I understand it's a symbol for all religious faith. But just wanted to point that out, mostly because of the nasty email I got from somebody earlier this week.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelson, and this bill does not require what they need in terms of this is something for the governor to designate a day for POW-MIA, and it's the policies of the VFWs, American Legions, how they conduct the ceremony. And it's a ceremony that's well It goes back many years.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Any additional discussion? Okay, so any closing remarks, Representative Detmer?
No, Mr. Chair and committee members, I think this is well overdue, and even though the federal government has passed this and put in law, I think it's time for Minnesota to follow suit. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. I will renew my motion that House File 172 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The bill is on its way. Thank you. Representative Lilly, I'm a little unclear exactly what is going on. Is there some sort of food outside that will not be there for very long? Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chair and members, it's been offered by the Speaker of the Minnesota House to have just some nourishment, knowing that we're going long and hard, all of us. If it's outside the door for the next few minutes, you could grab something and come back in, or you could take a three-minute recess. Whatever you want to do, you're the chair. It's your prerogative. But it's open to both sides of the aisle and staff. And I saw some public grabbing some stuff, too. So it's it's right outside the door if you're interested. I don't know how you want to handle it, Mr. Chair.
I think out of respect for Representative Pearson and his testifier who's here, I'd like to keep going. If any members, I would request no more than one or two at a time go out to do that, to get that. And my understanding is it's not going to be there for much longer. So you're welcome to go out, get that, bring it back in. But I would like to keep us on schedule here since we only have one bill left and Representative Pearson has waited a while already. But as I said, if members would like to step out temporarily, they are able to do that. So Representative Pearson, I will move that House File 1861 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You could please present your bill.
Thank you, and thank you, members. I'm actually not going to speak very long about the only thing I really wanted to share with you is some of you who have been in the legislature for a while know that I have a personal contact with the country of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Many of you have met my oldest adopted son, Mardashe, and he's been in the United States for 3 years, which happens to be coincidentally an anniversary of when this bill was heard 3 years ago, actually, in 2016, as it was authored by Representative Phyllis Kahn. And I'm very pleased that I can pick up the mantle and hopefully carry this forward and get it signed into law. The other personal touch that a few of you are holding in your hand right now, that we all have a little connection with the Democratic Republic of Congo, is the fact that there's a mineral in your cell phone, coltan, is I believe the kind of the generic name for it, and coltan's the one mineral that makes your cell phone vibrate. So every time my cell phone vibrates, I think of this, and I think of the story that you're about to hear, and it's going to be hard not to pass this bill if you start thinking about that every time your cell phone vibrates. So with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Ellen Kennedy. Chair Freiberg, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to talk about House File 1861. You've all heard of diamonds that were used in the 1980s to finance brutal conflict in parts of Africa. They were known as blood diamonds. Today, a similar tragedy is happening because, as you've heard, there are minerals in our small electronics, in our phones, in our laptops, our computers, and more. The minerals are called 3TGs, tin, tungsten, tantalum, also known as coltan, and gold. And as you heard, coltan makes our phones vibrate. Most of the world's coltan comes from Congo. Brutal militia groups fight in eastern Congo over these valuable minerals. They're called conflict minerals. Innocent people, especially as you will hear, women and girls, are the victims. Since 1996, more than 6 million people have been killed in Congo. This is the deadliest conflict since World War II. In 2010, the U.S. government passed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act. Section 1502 of this bill requires that publicly traded U.S. electronics companies like Apple, Intel, and Motorola report to the Securities and Exchange Commission every year where they buy the minerals that they use in their products. If any of these conflict minerals came from Congo or a neighboring country, the company must describe its due diligence to determine the source of the minerals. This bill, Dodd-Frank, does not require companies to divest from Congo or to get their minerals only from conflict-free mines. The law simply requires companies to report where they get the minerals and the due diligence that they practice. The idea is simple. Having a transparent supply chain will help companies to be motivated to buy from mines that use good practices because the company's reports are public. In 2012, the city of Edina, Minnesota, adopted a resolution requiring that Edina's city electronics be purchased with from companies that are compliant with Dodd-Frank. In 2014, the Minnesota State Bar Association did the same thing. California, Maryland, and Massachusetts have passed the same legislation. A similar bill is now pending in Oregon. Why should Minnesota get involved in what's going on in Congo? We have a state precedent. In 2008, the Minnesota legislature and then Governor Pawlenty passed a bill to divest our state public pension fund with a great deal of money from companies complicit with the Darfur genocide. Minnesotans very simply did not want their tax dollars supporting a genocide on the other side of the world. In 2016, as Representative Pearson said, this same bill about conflict minerals came before the Minnesota legislature. It passed unanimously in the House committee. It passed unanimously in the Senate committee. It passed on the Senate floor. Again, Minnesotans did not want their money spent on products that were complicit with unspeakable violence. But in 2016, the bill never got to the House floor. The crisis is not over. People are still being murdered. Women and girls still face unspeakable brutality. Today, I ask you to support the transparent purchasing of electronics by our state government. Every time we use our phones, it's a reminder of our complicity. Last year, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to Dr. Denis Mukwege from Congo. He received it for his efforts to end sexual violence as a weapon of war. Our next speaker, Dr. Edwige Mubanzi, worked alongside him in Congo. She has seen the violence firsthand, and her life has been forever touched by those victims. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Kennedy. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and member of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify at today's hearing regarding the conflict minerals bills of my dear country. My name is Edwige Mubanzi. I am a medical doctor from the Democratic Republic of Congo. In my country, I worked in the Panzi Hospital Mobile Clinic that went to rural areas to find and treat women victims of rape and mutilation. I worked alongside my mentor, Dr. Denis Mukwege, a co-recipient of the 2018 Nobel Peace Prize. Rape is used as a weapon of war in Congo. The war is about controlling our mineral resources, especially coltan, which is used for cell phones, computers, all over the world. 80% of the world's supply of coltan comes from the eastern part of Congo, where I am from. Since 1998, more than 400,000 women and girls have been raped in this war. Today, my country is called the rape capital of the world. Rape is an effective war strategy, and it's destroying my community. Usually, women are raped in front of their husbands and children. This destroys the whole family and enables malicious to control population and therefore the mineral resources. After raping a woman, militia members often insert blunt, dangerous objects into her vagina to destroy her body. This practice not only destroys a woman's body, often causing leakage of body fluid from the vagina and the inability to have children. It completely destroys her spirit. At Panzi Hospital, I performed hundreds of operations to repair this wound of rape. I would like to share a story of one of my patients. During a night shift at Panzi Hospital, I received a woman that I knew because I had treated her before. She was a victim of rape and became pregnant from that rape. This time she came with her 6-month-old baby. I was afraid that she had been raped again. But she told me that she had not come for herself, she had come for her baby. Her baby, born of rape, was raped at 6 months old. This has become an intergenerational problem in my country. The physical findings were heartbreaking. This was the reason I decided that besides treating my patients, I also had to advocate for them. And this is why I'm here today. We all know how the exploitation and illegal trade of natural resources is linked to financing armed groups and massive human rights violations. I and we cannot solely repair the consequences of the violence. We must treat the root cause of this violence to put an end to these horrific crimes. Minerals from Congo need to be mined in a lawful manner that respects the life of all people. This is why I'm here, engaged in a plea for peace, justice, and respect for human rights. It's urgent to act. The solution exists and requires real political will. Mr. Chair and member of the committee, the vote in support of this bill will be a victory for human rights and stability in my country, the Democratic Republic of Congo. With humility and hope, I now urge you to support this legislation to help transform blood minerals into minerals for development and peace. This is an opportunity to solve the real problem of Congo, and we need your support. Thank you again for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you for your testimony, Doctor. Is there an additional testifier?
Chair Freiberg, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Erickson. I am the Policy and Programs Manager at World Without Genocide. Dr. Kennedy mentioned that improvements have been made in Congo since implementing Dodd-Frank. I'd like to share some of those advancements. Congolese officials, the UN, the US, and many organizations developed a conflict-free certification and audit process. This is modeled on the Kimberley Process Certification Scheme that reduced trade in blood diamonds 15 years ago. In 2010, before Dodd-Frank, no mines were certified as conflict-free. Today, 495 mines are conflict-free. Publicly held companies like Apple and Motorola buy minerals. If those minerals originate in Congo or adjoining countries, companies must report to the SEC which mines, smelters, and refineries they buy them from, and those reports are made public. The mines undergo audits by reliable organizations to determine if they are conflict-free. The audits are conducted in accordance with standards that apply to other SEC requirements and with standards established by the Comptroller General of the United States. A conflict-free mine receives certification to that effect. Minerals sold from mines without this certification are appraised at much lower values because companies don't want to buy from uncertified mines. Armed militia groups responsible for the violence in eastern Congo make less from minerals from uncertified mines and find it difficult to sell minerals from uncertified mines. A year ago, in March 2018, the Trump administration adopted new standards for federal purchasing of electronics such as computers and monitors. These standards include conflict mineral provisions, including due diligence, whether the company is helping to build the conflict-free trade in Congo and the region, and whether the company is sourcing from audited, conflict-free suppliers. In effect, this strengthens the Dodd-Frank legislation. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency has adopted these criteria for federal purchasers to the United States, as well as others around the globe, such as the EU, who are now required to procure products that meet the standard. As of the most recent study by the International Peace Information Service in 2016, 79% of 3TG miners did not work under the control of armed actors. This bill increases Minnesota's dedication to transparency in government spending. This is good fiscal policy and is also good ethics. I want to share words from a Congolese community leader working in the mining areas. He said, "As a native of Congo, I have seen firsthand what things are like on the ground. Gang rape, modern child slavery, and violations on a massive scale. Some people may not understand how a U.S. law related to corporate supply chain sourcing practices could stop this horrific decades-long conflict. However, the Dodd-Frank Act has done much to reduce violence in my country. It is one of the main reasons why armed groups no longer wield the power they once enjoyed." Unless the situation continues to improve, women and girls in Congo will continue to suffer, so that women and girls like me, in safe places like Minnesota, can use cell phones and other electronics without even thinking about the consequences. But I think about those consequences, you've heard those consequences, and I urge you to think about them, too. We can make a difference in Congo from Minnesota. I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Erickson. Is there anybody else who would like to speak on House File 1861? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Betsy Hayes. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer with the Department of Administration's Office of State Procurement, and I appreciate the opportunity today to testify regarding House File 1861. The Office of State Procurement conducts over $2.5 billion in purchasing each year. We administer over 1,200 statewide master contracts involving a wide array of commodities and services that are used by state agencies and local units of government. We strive diligently not only to ensure that our contracts represent the best value for our end users, but that our process is streamlined and efficient as possible. This is extremely important, especially for our small and emerging businesses who sometimes struggle when attempting to navigate the processes necessary to do business with the state. The procurement process is sometimes used as a method to implement very important policy provisions, such as the one addressed here in House File 1861. Other examples of this include things like implementing affirmative action, equal pay, sustainability requirements, small and diverse business preferences, E-Verify, prevailing wages, IT accessibility standards, and the list goes on. And while I very much appreciate the critical policy considerations behind these bills, and in particularly the very important policy considerations here in this bill, It is important to understand that there is a cumulative impact of addressing all these types of social objectives within our procurement process. It can slow down an already lengthy process, add complexity, and can add costs. By way of example, our standard RFP template is currently 49 pages. We have been told, especially by our small and emerging businesses, that we need to remove the barriers by making the process more streamlined and efficient, and we've worked hard to do that. But if, however, it is the legislature's will to implement this policy via the procurement process, I do have some suggestions that might make the bill more administratively feasible, and we'd be happy to work with the author or any to implement this very important policy. We would suggest that a shift in the language to requiring the vendors to attest or certify compliance with the federal reporting requirements rather than having it as a prohibition on the state procurement official. Second, to consider possibly a monetary threshold that's similar to affirmative action or equal pay, where the bill applies to contracts over a certain dollar level. This assures that it encompasses the contracts that we enter into but doesn't cause an administrative problem with, for example, a small purchase is made using a purchasing card. We would recommend consideration of an exception provision in the event of an unusual circumstance, perhaps an administrative error in the reporting process on the vendor's part where the state can't practically utilize a different resource. So that would be in such as single source scenarios. And then it's also important with these bills for the need of a specific language of an effective date that provides that the section is effective on a specific date and applies to solicitations issued on or after that date. And again, I'd be happy to work with the author to assist with any of these potential changes for consideration to help us administer the bill more effectively. In closing, I just want to reemphasize that my remarks are not intended at all to speak to the merits of the important policies in that this bill addresses, but rather the focus is purely on the practicalities of implementation and administration of the bill if it were to become law. Thank you for the time you've given me to share my comments, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes. Is there anyone else who would like to testify regarding House File 1861? Okay, seeing none, is there a member discussion? Representative Vogel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question, I guess, Ms. Hayes. I'm not familiar with all of the language of Dodd-Frank, but could I assume that any changes that would be made here would be no less burdensome on the private sector than they would be on the state? In other words, that if the Dodd-Frank mandates a certain threshold, that the state wouldn't have any more of a threshold or whatever, so that we're at least being consistent with the private sector?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I think it would be consistent. I don't see anything in the bill that would create any inconsistencies or differences between the two sectors.
Representative Vogel?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Any additional discussion? Representative Salk?
Representative Pearson, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pearson, okay, first of all, I'm struggling to hear because it's the way my life is. So I may be off a little bit, and then you can steer me back. With the suggestions or the concerns that were about procurement, can you remember them and go down the list as to which ones you think would be things you could actually work with to get them able to do their jobs in a peaceful kind of coexistence? First, I'll just ask it that way, and I may follow up.
I appreciate that, Representative Salk, and I think Representative Vogel's line of questions actually brings some of this in, and actually Ms. Hayes had sent an email earlier, and I do know that Ellen has already answered some of these questions, but would be happy to share some of that information with you at this time, if we may, Mr. Chair.
Kennedy?
Great. Thank you, Chair and Representative. One of the issues that Ms. Hayes raised had to do with dates. This is not a bill that has anything retroactive about it. I think the most important thing is to remember what I mentioned in my introductory remarks, and that is that this is federal legislation having to do only with those companies that are publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange, okay, that are governed by the Securities and Exchange Commission. When they are purchasing minerals that are bought in Congo or in neighboring countries, those companies like Apple, Motorola, Intel, and so on must publicly report every year where they buy the products. They don't need to buy only from certain companies. They don't need to divest from companies that are not conflict-free. They simply need to report. So our language in the bill is simply reinforcing the existing federal legislation. You heard Sarah Erickson add to that that the current administration is reinforcing Dodd-Frank through the EPA and its actions, as are countries around the world. So this does not apply to, for example, small electronics producers that are not involved in publicly held corporations.
Representative Stout.
So I'd like to get a commitment to get to parity or some sort of like, okay, we can work this out kind of statement, just for my sense of this. I'm of the strength that I would close the book on the opportunity to purchase at all. So that's a very black and white, very harsh position from which I need to move. Now, there's a pragmatic and a practical sense of this. I've owned my own company. There are times when procurement actually ties you in knots, and I think that we are getting painfully close to that in terms of the state of Minnesota for procurement. So I'm looking for some way to be assured that there is a place where there's an agreement available that the state would be able to purchase things to do the job. I don't mean that they need to be guaranteed to go out there, and I don't need to be personally guaranteed that I can go to the Internet and buy whatever I want. I'm really looking for a place where, yep, we can come to a place where the state can procure what it needs and the need or the mission for your concerns are met.
Representative Pearson, I know Ms. Hayes offered to work with you.
Absolutely. And I would say, Mr. Chair, if I may, you would be hard-pressed to find a company out there that doesn't follow this. This actually is a statement from the state of Minnesota strengthening that commitment. On the back side of the handout, you'll see actually basically a scorecard, and everything from, well, this is supposed to be a color copy, by the way. It's green at the top and red at the bottom. You can read in the description the different companies and what they do comply with to get that green score. What's important to know is even the companies that are scoring red are complying with this law, with Dodd-Frank. So while they may not be buying minerals from the conflict-free mines, which we'd like to see, this is really about transparency. And this bill is having Minnesota make that statement that we support that transparency. What we're really about is protecting the consumer, much like the conflict diamonds era from 15, 20 years ago. The consumer did not want to find out that this investment they had made came from extremely awful conditions, much like I don't want to think about that when my cell phone vibrates. And so we're finding out which companies are doing a good job, which companies are not doing such a good job, but it doesn't limit the state of Minnesota from buying from any of the companies on that entire spectrum. And like she mentioned, a Fortune 500 company, anyone who's publicly traded is in the Dodd-Frank rules, so they have to abide by that, and they have to report, good or bad. And so this is just saying that they need to be buying from someone who's reporting.
All right. Representative Bonner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pearson, and I guess this is a question perhaps for our last testifier, but First of all, I want to thank you, Representative Pearson, for this piece of legislation. I really find it extremely valuable, and you know, as many of you in this room know, I am a firm defender of rights and very passionate about women's issues, so I thank you for bringing this forward. It's very important. The question that I had for the last testifier was, you had mentioned that you wanted to shift the onus of making sure that people are reporting accurately to the vendor as opposed to someone in the state. And I'm just curious how that would work, and how do we have a guarantee that that vendor is giving us truthful and accurate information? Because I guess that's a real concern for me, that we're getting the correct information. I'm a little concerned that vendors might not be as forthcoming.
Ms. Hayes.
Mr. Chair and Representative, with the many other provisions that we administer, whether it be affirmative action, equal pay, e-verify is another, we usually have provisions in our solicitation documents that it could be a separate certification, or it might be a clause in the solicitation that says that the vendor has to certify that they're in compliance with certain provisions. That is typically the mechanism. You'll notice, like, this session there's several bills on net neutrality, and that is how those are typically set forward. And then the vendor has to submit, they sign it, sometimes they have to have it notarized, like for an affidavit of non-collusion, that kind of thing. And the threat, I guess, about honesty for them is that if they submit any false statements on a bid document, they face suspension or debarment from state procurement, which could carry on for not just our state, but for local jurisdictions and other states, which really can have a terrible impact. So I think they have a incentive there to not submit false statements that way. So that is one way. But the reality is that for many of these items, it's that vendor self-certification that we have to rely on, simply because of a resource issue with the state and not really being able all the time with these many issues to go out and investigate to see whether or not, for example, a company has discriminated against Israel, or whether they have comply with E-Verify. We have to rely on their certifications.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess my curiosity is if there's any way to verify, because I guess here's where I'm thinking. So we talked about how from then to now, right, and we have about 80% of folks who are now working in mines that do not have the threat of armed militia overseeing them, right? So we know that. But that leaves 20%. And here is, and if there's enough incentive for those groups to continue, my worry is that there will also be an incentive with vendors to not always be truthful. And I guess what I'm thinking about is, how do we close that gap for that 20%? Because I don't want to see any more women or children in your clinic.
Dr. Kennedy?
Thank you, Chair and Representative. Regarding Dodd-Frank, I just want to remind everyone that this is reporting that's mandated by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Falsifying that kind of reporting is going to result, I'm sure, in extremely serious consequences. So I think what we're hoping to do is what these other states have done, and that is to say, these federal standards are there. These federal standards are moving us forward. We're not at 100%. But as you heard Sarah Erickson say as well, from the advocate on the ground in Congo, as you've heard Dr. Mubanzi testify as well, these are efforts that are being taken around the world that step by step are making a difference. This is a small step for Minnesota compared to states like California or Massachusetts that have passed similar bills. Our budget is much smaller. Our procurement is much less complicated. Yet we checked today, in fact, and there have been no problems in any of those states. And the legislation that we are putting forward has been the same legislation from those states. Thank you.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that. like I said, I'm hoping that we can get one step closer to eradicating this.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Any additional member discussions? Any closing remarks, Representative Pearson?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1861 be recommended to pass and referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Yes, that is correct. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for waiting to the end of the meeting. We're meeting tomorrow, Tuesday, March 12th, at the normal committee time, with the possibility that we may come back in the evening. And I will obviously make sure everyone knows about if that were to happen as soon as possible. So no further comments or questions. We are adjourned.